another edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. This time, I'm talking to John Hogan, Registrar at the University of Newcastle, and we'll be reviewing John's career. We'll be going back to the 80s, talking about the University of Warwick, where we both worked and we've been there before, looking at some big financial issues from recycling envelopes to saving money on phone calls, and the big issues around COVID-19 and the challenges that represents for universities, but also for all of us working from home in lockdown. And then we'll look at some of the challenges ahead for our sector. So it's a different kind of episode. Do enjoy. And welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time, instead of my usual partner in crime, Dave Hall, I am very pleased to welcome Dr. John Hogan, who is registrar at the University of Newcastle. So welcome, John. And just to start us off, it'd be really helpful to hear about how you ended up at Newcastle and your long and illustrious career to date.
Yes, hello, Paul. And not sure about the illustrious bit, certainly long career. So I've started my higher education administration career in the mid-1980s, originally at the University of Warwick and then on to the University of Durham, and from there to Newcastle quite a few years ago now. So I've been at Newcastle a long time, in fact, close to 18 years. So you think I've seen most of it, but I haven't, because I've never seen anything like this before.
Well, that is indeed a long time. I started slightly later. But when I did start in higher education, people were still talking, and this was a few years on in the 80s, about those cuts and the impact they had at the beginning of the 80s. And many of the people I was working with, you know, really bore the scars of coming through that traumatic period at the beginning of that decade. So was that the case for you as well?
Very much so, Paul. So I started mid-80s, and we were, the cuts in 1981 and the consequent cuts throughout the 1980s actually were being felt in ways which until a few weeks ago sounded ridiculous. You know, we used to regard it as important to reuse envelopes, for example, not at that stage anyway, because we were saving the planet, but because we were saving money. We used to do things like not be allowed to make telephone calls in the morning because the rate of telephone charges was slightly higher in the morning than the afternoon. And if you look back at some of the papers then, some of the proposals to save money seem completely penny-pinching by today's standards. So it was a period, if not austerity, then certainly there had been a shock to the system and people were adjusting when I first started to higher education.
I must admit, I'd forgotten that afternoon calls were cheaper than morning ones. I do remember the recycling of envelopes, but that was, of course, in the days when we all wrote memos to each other. So thinking about that time at Warwick when you were there, and I know it's part of the myth and legend of the place, but they really did pursue a different path with making money and saving money in response to those cuts, and the idea that they would grow rather than shrink along with the rest of the sector. And yes, there is a lot of mythology about it, but it's undoubtedly the case that they laid the foundations for what has become an incredibly successful university. Was it your sense at the time that that was what they were trying to do?
Yes, very much so. It had this clever strategy of saving half, making half. And although it was just sort of buzz line, it actually set a bit of a mind frame that the university could do something on its own to get out of this financial difficulty. In the end, of course, the making half of it was actually primarily down to international student numbers, if you look back on the figures. But that's no bad thing. And the whole sector has benefited enormously from international student numbers over the years, until maybe now.
So what about those other things, those commercial aspects, the kind of conferences, business, etc.? Was that really taking off in the 80s?
Yes, indeed. So there were some very useful initiatives, but initially they were tied to the academic activity of the university. So whether engineering were putting on particular CPD programs and needed a residential base, that provided a very strong case for an investment in residential hotel type facilities on the campus. And the university did very well on that. It was pioneering and entrepreneurial, and it worked well. But of course, it wasn't immune from the need to make what seem to be nowadays very mean decisions on tight expenditure and so on. So I gave a couple of examples earlier. So the make half was important, but also there was definitely a save half, which the vast majority of institutions went through in the 1980s. This was a decade when people had to be very careful about how they were spending money.
Thinking about the environment that we're going into now is even more challenging than that period in 1981 onwards, and I think that we're going to be even more severely affected. Now, those universities that were most affected back then, I always think of Salford and Aston, who had significant cuts. But I think the cuts that we're going to face now are even more severe than those they faced in the 80s.
Well, I fully agree with that, Paul, because not only do we have the obvious financial worries, which are still yet unmapped out, but we have the combination of that with severe concerns about well-being, both personal, but with family members and so on. This sense of not knowing what the full consequences of this virus will be for the UK population, for the world population over a period of time. And that double combination of well-being concerns plus all the sort of normal social economic concerns, I think, makes it psychologically and materially worse than anything I can remember from the 1980s.
So thinking about the past couple of months then, what would you say that has taken place at Newcastle? How did the institution respond? We moved very, very quickly from preparation into lockdown and then online learning. So how did you feel it actually went at Newcastle?
So I think the experience at Newcastle was probably similar to other universities. We were aware of the virus. We had meetings with the emergency management team about what we would do in certain scenarios, what we were planning to do. Initially, it was about students and staff members who were overseas, bringing them back from China and so on. And we were aware once the university system in Italy closed down the physical campus for a period of time that this could be a consequence for the UK. But I don't mind admitting that even with that awareness, the actual accelerated process of the final few days leading towards what effectively was a distance remote teaching scenario came across very sudden, and there was concern about it. That said, I think Newcastle, and as far as I can see, the vast majority of the university sector in the UK has adjusted remarkably quickly. And there's a sort of issue about university being slow to change, slow to react. Well, nobody could say that about this particular crisis. I think people reacted remarkably effectively and efficiently.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Absolutely agree with you there. It was a kind of real step into the unknown, wasn't it? I mean, many people, some people, were used to working at home already. We've got people doing it, but there's also can't forget those people who still have to stay on campus. Looking after students who are staying in halls, catering for them, security staff, those looking at the, ensuring that the buildings are safe, running animal facilities, doing critical research, etc. And it's a very different experience for them.
Very much so. And I think for someone like myself, I've never really enjoyed working at home. Never really enjoyed working at home. But of course, inevitably, I had to do it. And there are a few reasons for that. One is the practical. The role that I've perform, I do think it's important to be seen and to see others. You know, those often quite short exchanges with colleagues help generate ideas, help generate the flow of business, help keep things going, keep your pulse on, finger on the pulse, that sort of issue. So I've always regarded it as quite important to be physically present. I remember joking when I was appointed at Newcastle that one of the things I'd go out and do was buy a new pair of shoes because I intended to get through a lot of footwear walking around the place. Now, that all feels rather distant now. But what I find is there's that side of it I'm missing. Then there's the sort of slight frustrations of working from home. So we've got four adults in the house and we're into a period of broadband wars. Sometimes I win. I hope we win for this broadcast. And sometimes I'm not so successful. So that's a frustration. But actually, yeah. The biggest thing for me has been the psychological side of it. Because when I've worked at home previously, it's been entirely to catch up with the work, to read the papers that I need to read, to do the emails that I need to do, typically on a Saturday morning. And by Monday, and maybe even by Sunday, I feel like I'm back on top of the work. But with this arrangement, every day, doesn't matter whether it's Saturday or Sunday, every day I feel like I'm slightly behind the curve of where I need to be for my work position. And you made a very important point, Paul, about, of course, some of our colleagues have had to be on campus, had to keep things going, our security teams, some of our cleaning teams, you mentioned the animal facilities. These people have been doing remarkable jobs, and I feel somewhat guilty that I'm not actually there. But that said, of course, there's this issue about leadership and demonstrating to all our colleagues that where you can work at home, you should do so. And that's been an important message for us to get across.
Yeah. In line with government requirements, though, we did have to all leave, almost all. And, you know, we have to keep ourselves safe. And that's part of that's also about keeping others safe and doing it for a reason. But we're also being good citizens, showing that we're following the rules and sticking with it. I think that one of the difficulties is, though, the kind of working practices of working from home. I mean, it means that we miss a lot of the rich extras around the kind of corridor conversations, the brief interactions before or after meetings, and the information shared, and a bit of the gossip. And it's all a bit disappointing that we lose all of that in the solo home working environment.
Very much so, Paul. I do find that particularly difficult. And Teams is fantastic and Zoom is fantastic. And we're making a lot of use of those systems. But it's not quite the same. And it is more complicated to use. It's not casual. You have to call, you have to book it, whatever it may be. So some of those sort of softer interactions have definitely disappeared for some time. Yeah. I mean, the thing people say to me more than anything else nowadays is, you're on mute, John. That's become the new sort of... No, I think it's because they want to hear me. But sometimes I just wonder when they say you're on mute as an instruction. Don't say anything more. Sorry, Paul, go on.
Yeah, the... your on mute phrase is certainly one that I've heard a lot. It's a pretty binary thing, isn't it? You know, you're either on mute or you're not, and we're still all getting it wrong. But I'm sure we'll get it right eventually. But the novelty of the whole online space has I'm sure waned for some, and I think it's undoubtedly the case that a lot of the richness you get from face to face interaction just disappears in these kind of meetings. And it is undoubtedly, as lots of colleagues have said, more draining emotionally and physically. It just takes more of it out of you.
Yeah, I fully agree with that, Paul. Can I come back a little bit as well on the point you made earlier about why we're working from home?
Sure.
Because the government gave us a very clear message and instruction, which was, I think, a good message, that in order to avoid the NHS being overwhelmed, we had a duty to minimise the risk of transmission to others. And I think we all bought into that. I think there was a bit of a game changer when the Prime Minister himself fell seriously ill. And at that point, suddenly the thought crossed certainly my mind, as someone who's the wrong side of 55, that this was actually not just about the risk to others, that actually more people in the population might be susceptible to a very serious form of this disease, and maybe even fatal version, than perhaps initially had been expected. And I think that's come as a big shock to some people, that this is actually extremely dangerous for many more people than perhaps originally was envisaged.
Yes, that's a really good point. I mean, I think when you hear about people that you know who have suffered from the virus and passed away, it does really bring it home. It makes it feel a lot more real. You really do feel for those who've had loved ones who they've lost.
So, sorry, Paul, I was going to say, I think one of the aspects that makes this quite uncertain is the almost random way in which some people seem to be completely poleaxed and others seem to have it in a relatively mild form. And that again leads to this degree of uncertainty about why on earth it's taken out somebody who seems reasonably fit and healthy, and others seem to recover without too much difficulty. So this is, it's obviously not random, but people don't understand the full set of factors yet.
It demonstrates that all of those researchers, the microbiologists, the virologists, the medics, all of those academic colleagues who suddenly got a high profile, demonstrates the real value of the research and the benefits that universities bring to society and to the economy. But I think we still struggle to demonstrate the need for universities to be supported. I mean, at the time of recording, we're still waiting to hear whether or not the Treasury is going to back a support package for universities. And our ability to get our arguments across about how important we are to the economy, to the future success of the country, we just don't seem to have achieved that as well as we should. I mean, you know, the position of institutions as kind of anchors in their community, really, really important. But we have to work harder on it, I think, to get our message across.
I think there's something in that. I mean, we do train the country's doctors, we train many of the nurses, yes. We train other health practitioners, the pharmacists and so on. We also have responsibilities, it seems to me, for generations of scientists who we would hope in the future will address this ongoing risk, which we all, I think, fully appreciate. So as a vehicle for handling some of the immediate issues arising from the COVID crisis, the universities are well placed. I appreciate, though, from the government's perspective, we're part of a very long line of organisations, businesses, sectors of the economy that are in need of additional help. So it is difficult to prioritise how the government's going to support the whole range of the economic and social activities.
So let's do assume, say that we get some support from government. Maybe it's not as much as we want. We're still going to have to undertake some pretty dramatic action, and it will be, you know, a bigger challenge financially than we've ever faced. But we know some institutions already facing difficulty. So, do you think that institutions will actually go bust? Do you think we will have mergers, voluntary or enforced?
I think these are really difficult questions, because everyone can understand entirely that if we do not have the student numbers, it will cause significant financial difficulties. And it's not just a question of numbers, but in a sense, how much people are willing to pay for the higher education experience that we can offer over the next year or maybe even 2 years. So I think these are problematic questions that threatened the organisation of all universities. We had a meeting of our governing body a few weeks ago when the crisis was underway, and it was by Zoom, of course. And I had to apologise in a way that I didn't present the risk register because the COVID crisis had turned every indicator on the risk register red. Everything. Everything had just changed to virtually unmanageable. Now, so we are picking up the pieces about how we're going to operate in the future. And I think no university can be entirely confident that it will get through this. You asked about closures and mergers. Well, universities are more than just another shop on the high street, if I can put it that way, although shops on the high street are pretty important too. So we have a root, a basis in our geography, in our positioning with our alumni and so on. So we have lots of potential friends and supporters. And I suppose, therefore, if it gets really tough, there'll be lots of people who say this organisation must be saved. At least I hope so, because nobody would want to see universities go under. It's in a sense so unfair, as it is for every part of the sector. This was not of anyone's making. This was not anyone's fault. This is nature, if you like, and we're going to have to battle through it, I hope, collectively. I hope that we can pull together as best we can. But of course, people will be deeply concerned about the way in which universities could go under as a result. I wouldn't like to predict whether that's going to happen. I certainly hope it doesn't.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, I really do fear for the future in some ways. There are, enormous challenges ahead. Of course, you could argue that, the Higher Education Research Act was, exactly intended to create the kind of environment, the competitive environment, where you'd have institutions that would fold. Indeed, it was an explicit part of the assumptions underlying that act. But I think we've all kind of moved on, and the kind of consequences of closure of an institution are just enormous for the staff, the students, the alumni, and the communities in which they're based. And that's just not just kind of social, but it's economic as well. And it just potentially has a devastating impact on communities and as well as institutions. So I just dread being in that position. So I mean, if you think about going back to the point we made about Warwick earlier, I mean, do you think that we'll face a situation where some universities, find a different way through these challenges and somehow come out of it stronger than others, a bit like Warwick did in the 80s?
I think where I struggle with this one is thinking about why most of our students at Newcastle come to Newcastle. And they do come. So if you're generous and draw a big circle around the northeast of England, based on Newcastle, you say a 50-mile radius, you capture a lot of sheep and you capture a lot of fish. Our geographic catchment area is not huge in terms of population. So roughly 3/4 of our UK students travel a long distance to arrive at Newcastle and study there, not to mention our international students. So why do they do that? Well, they, of course, want the educational experience. Of course, they want the degree, but they also want the life experience. They want to go to university. And that's true of many of the universities in this country. And I find it difficult to imagine completely re-engineering the university to a way in which we can just offer a parallel experience remotely. I think it'll be very different. So we are beginning to look at what it means come October, September. And the part of that equation which I'm struggling with most is, let's assume that we still have a requirement for physical distancing come October, which is sounds like quite likely. What would it mean for someone perhaps arriving at university for the first time to be expected to keep a physical distance from every other student that they meet during the course of the first term? How realistic is that? How can it be managed? How can we minimise the risk? How can we just facilitate some form of better experience than that might suggest? And I think these are really difficult challenges. So if a university could manage this effectively, safely, reducing the risk, I think they may be in a stronger position than those that just say either we're going to delay or we're going entirely online.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Everyone will want to make it as much a real kind of campus experience as it can, although it will be really challenging. I mean, maybe we'll see, you know, the institutions that will succeed are the ones that manage to make as much of their own branded PPE as possible to provide to all their staff and students. So thank you, John. That's been a really both optimistic and at times pessimistic conversation, but absolutely fascinating. I'm enormously grateful for your time. And thank you very much for participating. That's all then from University Registrars Talking About Stuff This Time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until the next time.